Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and spring is really happening. My name is Kathy Converse. My pronouns are she and her. And assisting me today is Randy Converse, and we have been members at Prairie for 30 years. Our Prairie UU congregation aspires to be open-hearted and open-minded. We're a family at Prairie, and we strive to be welcoming to all. We're committed and we're continually work toward embracing all people with their differences in age, abilities, skin color, sexual orientation, and family structure. During a virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we'll invite visitors and guests to introduce themselves so we can get to know you a little bit better. We're also welcome and anyone's expression of joys and sorrows during that time. And then we'll break into small groups for discussion and general chatting. We have a few announcements. They're also in the order of service, which was emailed with the Prairie News. We're sharing an offering this quarter with Wilma Fund. This is assistance to homeless members of the LGBTQ community within Dane County. You can go to the order of service or to the Prairie website and click give. Monday at 7 o'clock is the Prairie Study Group. They're meeting on the second and fourth Mondays. Thursday night, 6:30 to 7 is fun with children, primarily younger children, but everyone's invited. And that's following that at 7 is the Prairie Sing-Along, which is open to everyone. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons is at 4:30 on Friday, and the beginning group is at noon on Saturday. Please help us. I want to mention next Sunday, we're going to be joining with Sauk County. So we'll be getting on at 10 a.m. on their website, not on our website. And that information will be within our website. So you will be connecting slightly differently. Please help us spread the word that Prairie is looking for a director of religious exploration. And there's a job posting on the Prairie UU homepage. You scroll down to the section that says we're hiring. The chalice reading today will be by Randy Converse. Feel free to light a candle or chalice at this time.
In times of darkness, we stumble towards the tiny flame. In times of cold, we seek the warming fire. In times of repression, we reach for the lamp of truth. In times of loss, we pray for the comforting light. In times of joy, we light a candle of celebration. Spirit of life, as we kindle this light, help us find what we need this day. By Brian Keeley.
We will now have a moment of silent meditation. Our story for all ages today is Hands Are Not for Hitting. This is by Martine Agassi and illustrations by Marika Heinlein, and Renee will put the book up for us.
Hands Are Not for Hitting by Martine Agassi, illustrated by Marika Heinlein. Hands come in all shapes, colors, and sizes. Hands can do lots of things. Can you wave yours? Hands are not for hitting. What are hands for? Saying hello. Drawing. Playing. Building. Hands are not for hitting. What are hands for? Eating and drinking. Dressing and undressing. Keeping safe. Taking care. Hands are not for hitting. What are hands for? Helping. Hugging. Waving. Goodbye. The end.
Our presentation today is Domestic Violence, Intimate Partner Violence 101 by Zoe Heitzinger. Zoe is a social worker and is currently the Prevention Outreach Specialist at DIAS. Her job primarily includes prevention in the form of MENS, which is Men's Encouraging Nonviolent Strength, clubs with middle and high school boys in the area. How wonderful. And outreach and education in the form of community presentation and awareness raising, such as she's doing for us today. Welcome, Zoe.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you all so much for inviting me in here today. This is so beautiful. I'm so just happy to be here with you all. So I'm going to share my screen. Alrighty. So yes, thank you so much once again for the introduction. I'm Zoe Heitzinger, Prevention Outreach Specialist at DAIS. I went to UW-Madison for both my undergrad and my graduate degree. So I graduated with my master's in social work a couple years ago. And it's just been wonderful to come to this work because I truly came not knowing how much passion I would have for this topic. So I get really excited to be able to come and speak with all types of different groups about this. So today I'm going to be going over intimate partner violence, domestic violence 101, how we can support survivors, especially through pandemic times, and a little bit about DAIS services as well. And before I really get into like the meat of my presentation today, I like to bring in some guidelines just to set the space for myself and for all of us. And the first one is safety for self. So domestic violence, intimate partner violence can be a really hard and really triggering topic for a lot of us to talk about, especially, you know, if we are showing up to the conversation, you know, in whatever way that looks like from everybody. So whatever you have to do to keep yourself safe during this presentation, I invite you to do that. If you need to eat, if you need to turn your camera off, if you need to drink, you know, some coffee or some tea, whatever that looks like for you, if you need to doodle, just make sure you're keeping yourself safe. And then secondly, safety for others. So if we're going to be sharing anecdotes or wisdom or experiences, I just want to make sure that we're keeping each other safe in this space as well. So don't share any identifying information. And then also recognize that, like I said, we're all showing up to this conversation in different ways. And then lastly, I just like to make the note about gendered language. So the statistics that I'll be bringing up and a little bit in the power and control wheel, you'll see some very gendered language in terms of, you know, statistically, we know that intimate partner violence, domestic violence happens most often to women or people who identify as women. But that is not to say that domestic violence, intimate partner violence doesn't happen in other relationships with other sexual orientations, gender identities, because it does. So I like to just make the note about gendered language that you'll hear me use more they, them pronouns, partner who experienced violence, partner who is choosing to use violence, just because I want to make sure I am wrapping in as many many members of the community as possible. Excuse me. So when we talk about domestic violence, intimate partner violence, language matters around this. So there is a little bit of a distinction between domestic violence and intimate partner violence. Domestic violence, domestic abuse refers to the legal term and is kind of what is in the law for what the crime is. So domestic violence, domestic abuse refers to two people in a home setting, marital spouse, long-term partner, and roommates that occupy the same living space. So intimate partner violence just brings in more people who might be experiencing violence or intimate partner violence, but who don't live with their partner or who aren't interacting with their partner on a daily basis. And then lastly, I like to make the note about victim versus survivor. So some people strongly don't want to identify as victims, and some people strongly want to identify as survivors. So it's always up to the person who is experiencing intimate partner violence to decide how they want to identify. And you'll hear me use victim, survivor interchangeably throughout this presentation. But when we're speaking in terms of, you know, this person first, person centered idea, it's always about how they want to identify. So what is intimate partner violence? What is domestic violence? It is the intentional use of power and control tactics by one intimate partner over the other in order to create an environment of fear and intimidation. So those purple words are purple and bolded for a reason. I like to say you don't lose control, you choose control. Intimate partner violence, domestic violence is always a choice. It might be exacerbated, by different things. And when we think about, stigma around domestic violence, but domestic violence is not a substance use disorder. Just domestic violence is not, mental health or mental, influx. It's not an anger management problem. It's always an intentional choice to use these tactics of power and control over the other partner. And I'll get into the power and control in a second, but it's the creation of that toxic environment of fear and intimidation. So that even if those really severe forms of violence that we think about, like physical or sexual violence, aren't happening, this environment ensures that the fear of those things happening always is rampant. And then just to reiterate, domestic violence occurs in all populations, regardless of race, sexual orientation, gender identity, socioeconomic status, education status, religious beliefs, geography, or disability. So I'm going to take us through just some general statistics that I like to bring into the space. And sometimes, now that we're living in this fully digital world, we are seeing a lot of things on our screens. So just take care of yourselves as you're reading these statistics, if any of them are really striking to you. The first one is that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men in the United States will be a victim during her or his lifetime. For same-sex couples, these numbers are pretty similar, but for trans-identifying individuals, the number is 1 in 2. So that goes way, way high up for the members of our trans community. The second one is that most cases of domestic violence are never reported to the police. If anything, domestic violence is one of the most or the most underreported crime that there is, because the person who is choosing to commit that act of violence is a loved one. And that can be really hard for everybody to see a loved one, have to go through a legal process. The third one is, on a typical day, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines nationwide. So like any given day of the week, you're looking at around 20,000 phone calls to the national hotlines. And then lastly, 72% of all murder suicides involve an intimate partner, and 94% of the victims of those murder suicides are female. So what does this look like in our backyard? What does this mean locally for us? It means that of the 253,000 women and girls who call Dane County home, over 63,000 of them have been or will be the victim of domestic violence at some point in their lives. And I mentioned that note around 20,000 calls a day for national hotlines. In 2019, we saw about 16,000 calls to our helpline just here in Dane County. And that number has done a really interesting thing in 2020 with the pandemic. It plateaued for a while at the beginning, which I'll get into later. And then we saw a significant spike kind of after we got messaging out, that we are still operating, we are still open, please still keep calling us. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the 2020 numbers hold for us. And then in 2019, domestic violence also claimed 72 lives in Wisconsin. This number comes from the homicide report that is put out by End Abuse Wisconsin, which is kind of our sister organization. They're statewide. And they put out this report at the end of the year, and that number includes if the perpetrator killed themselves in the process and if children were killed as well. And then lastly, DAYS estimates that there are around 12,000 incidents of domestic violence in Dane County annually, or around 33 per day. So it's here, it's in our backyard, but I love the chance to focus on the good, and that, I get to come in and talk about these things with different groups, to kind of bring this awareness to the forefront. So I like to bring this in before I go into the power and control wheel. I bring this quote in because this is one of the most accurate snapshots we have from what we see at DAYS with our clients, from what we hear from community partners, and that it's abuse usually isn't consistent or constant. So in between, you become a normal couple. you plan dinner together, you go to work, you watch TV. Whenever there's a break in the violence, whether it's emotional or physical, you are lulled into a sense of complacency. And this is from the Why I Stayed campaign that was on Twitter a couple of years ago. It kind of was the predecessor of the Me Too movement, was the hashtag Why I Stayed. And it was started by a Black woman activist who basically just took to Twitter. I think it was something like he promised he would change. He lied, and here we are, hashtag Why I Stayed. And a bunch of people followed suit, and then it became a thing, a campaign. And then I bring in this cycle, right? So oftentimes we see relationships and domestic violence relationships start in this honeymoon phase where everything feels great. The person checks all of the boxes. You spend all of your time together. You're constantly texting or calling, in this digital world. but then that honeymoon phase builds to this moment of tension, right? Or this tension building phase where say the other partner then starts becoming more moody or more nitpicky. Maybe there is substance use that wasn't there before that is starting to come out. This is also when we see tactics of isolation, of cutting off support networks start to happen. And this is the phase in which the victim or the person who is experiencing violence is going into this trauma response of appeasement. So you've heard of flight, fight, and freeze. We include flight, fight, freeze, and appease in the trauma response. So this is when that person who is experiencing violence is trying to calm the other person down constantly. Maybe they start making, you know, a favorite meal more often for that person. Maybe they do stop seeing family or friends that the partner said weren't good or they didn't want them around. It's this thing, this general feeling of walking on eggshells, right? And then that builds to this moment of violence. And a moment of violence could be what we think about when we think of, you know, physical violence or sexual violence. But it can also be something as simple as yelling at you in the middle of a grocery store or humiliating you when you're out with a group of your friends. It's anything that threatens the emotional and physical well-being and safety of a person. And as we know, with cycles, that they are destined to repeat themselves. So then the cycle goes right back into that honeymoon phase where it's, oh my God, baby, I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. Or that is not me. I will never do that again. I don't ever want to hurt you. Or maybe it looks like showering that person in gifts and flowers to kind of make light of what had happened. And then there's one thing I do want to say is that not all relationships do fit into this cycle, and that everybody who experiences domestic violence experiences it differently because everybody is dealing with trauma and experiences trauma differently. And then as a result, everybody copes with trauma differently. So I like to bring that into the space as well. So this is the power and control wheel. This is our general one that we use. We have this inside joke at Days that we have a wheel for anything because this wheel has been adapted into so many different versions for teens, for college students, for the medical field, for the LGBTQIA community. But this is the general one that I wanted to bring in here. So before I go through the wedges, I wanted to say that, so all of these wedges are valid forms of abuse, excuse me. And then you have the thick black ring of physical and sexual violence. So even if physical and sexual violence aren't happening, all of these wedges ensure that the threat is not there, the threat is not only there, but that it could happen at any time, like that any of these wedges, if they were severe enough, could end in physical or sexual violence. So we start with coercion and threats, which is what we think about, you know, making somebody do something that they don't want to do, threatening to leave, threatening to commit suicide, whatever that looks like in that relationship. And then we move into intimidation. So, you know, using intimidating glances, gestures, actions, intimidating someone in a way that also when they're out in public, you know, that makes them, makes that person experiencing violence turn inward, right? It's this, you know, fear and intimidation. And then there's emotional abuse. And I like to pause here for a second, just because I like to make the note that emotional abuse is often one of the most rampant forms of abuse that happens, but it is often the quote unquote hardest to prove. And it's the hardest to prove, especially in a legal setting. So when we think about victims and survivors addressing barriers to disclosing or to seeking help, that you can't prove emotional violence. So if you're trying to get away from, you know, this person who is choosing to commit an act of violence against you, and you don't have anything to, you know, show for it, that believability of the person goes down, right? So I like to just stop here and pause to make that note. But emotional abuse, you know, looks like put downs. It looks like telling you what you can and can't wear or eat. It's often gaslighting, you know, denying someone else's reality about what's happening. And it's anything, you know, that throws that person who is experiencing the violence into this state of confusion. You know, is this abuse that's happening to me? Oh, they said they're sorry. I guess it's not. So emotional abuse is a big one. And then you have isolation, you know, so cutting off that person from their friends and family, their support system. And isolation can also be, you know, tangibly isolating someone from leaving the house. And we've seen that also with the pandemic at the beginning, especially when we were kind of all under this, you know, quarantining, isolating at home, that we were noticing a lot of people were having to quarantine or isolate with their abusive partners. So, you know, that physical space of isolation as well. And then we move into minimizing, denying, and blaming. That's pretty self-explanatory, but this one also includes using jealousy as a means to justify the actions. So, you know, well, you were talking, and, you know, I'm going to use a gendered example, but, you know, if it's a heterosexual couple, say the woman, you know, was talking to a male cashier, and that her partner then said something like, I don't like it when you talk to men, like you know, I'm just jealous of you all of the time. I don't know, you're just too pretty or whatever it might be. But, you know, making that other person feel like it's their fault. And then we get into using children. And this one, to me, is very heavy. So, you know, using children can include using the children, if there's a separation, to relay messages or to relay, you know, comments to the other parent. It can look like, you know, if they're in the same house, using the child as, you know, a pawn in the argument or as a basis for why something happened. And it's really damaging on the, you know, family unit as a whole, as well too. And then economic abuse, we've seen this one come out a lot more with the pandemic, but economic abuse includes anything that has to do with, you know, money or even, you know, the establishment of an allowance to somebody else. It's, you know, only filling up the gas tank so that the other person can only go to work and home. You know, whatever that looks like, economic abuse is one that is also very rampant. And then lastly, we end on male privilege. And I like to make the caveat that male privilege, you know, is only in here because we live under a patriarchal society, and that, you know, we see that play out in relationships and even in same-sex relationships with this idea of, you know, being the one to define what the man and woman's role is, or being the one to define who does what in the relationship. So that is the power and control wheel. And then there's one that's not on here that I like to include, again, especially that relates directly to the pandemic, and that is digital abuse. So that is monitoring communications, demanding sexual photos, excessively texting someone or calling, hacking, posting private images or messages, demanding check-ins, tracking someone's location, and then posting cruel things about a partner. And I put some asterisks by the top there, the top one, just because monitoring communications is really something that we as loved ones should consider. So if I'm on a Zoom call with a friend and I see their partner do something or say something to them, and then say we get off the Zoom call and I go to text my friend and I say, hey, I don't like how so-and-so spoke to you, or I don't know if I really liked what that person did in the background of the Zoom call. If my friend's partner is monitoring their communications, I just put their safety at risk, because then that partner could say something like, No more Zoom calls with Zoe. She doesn't like me. I don't think her judgment is great. She's not a good friend to you if she's gonna hate on our relationship or however that looks. So just keeping in mind that the safest way to talk to our friends is always if we can do it safely at a 6-foot distance, or if we can ask them for a moment of alone time. Excuse me. I just spilled a little bit. So digital abuse continued for just to talk about the pandemic specifically, how we've seen it, is these threats via social media in whatever way that looks like, especially if the two partners aren't living together. Pressure to break quarantine, disobey the family or the pod or the unit rules about leaving the space. Saying things like, if you don't text me back right now, I'm going to this, or, you know, I'm going to do this to myself. I know you're home on your phone. Calling, texting, harassing constantly so that they can't get work done, spend time with others or alone, and spreading false information. And I bring this quote in also to talk a little bit more about the pandemic. This is from a great New York Times article that was written. It says, home isolation, however vital to the fight against the pandemic, is giving still more power to the abuser, from this doctor. She says, if suddenly people have got to be at home, that gives him an opportunity suddenly to call the shots around that, to say what she should or shouldn't be doing. And like I mentioned, we noticed this happen a lot at the beginning of the pandemic, that, you know, with mass closures, churches, libraries, and schools shutting down for that period of time before everybody kind of adapted to the online platforms, you know, but these things resulted in, you know, limited childcare options or adaptation of childcare, where, you know, if the kids were going to grandma's house on Thursdays and that was a safe space, you know, if grandma is in the high risk category, that there goes that childcare option, you know, and then also including losses of income and significant losses of income, diminished resources for helping or just in general, you know, to ask somebody how long the wait is often when you call the unemployment office, you know, it's diminished resources everywhere. And that these safe places outside of the home are limited. And then also, you know, having the reduced contact with the outside world, those safe people who might have been there often, not being able to be there as often. And then, you know, therapy or these other helping resources, either being shut down fully or adapted, but privacy being a risk factor for those adaptations, right? We don't know who is in the next room listening if they're on a therapy call. I'm just looking at my time here. So just to go through these quickly, significant shifts in the daily routine as well. Like I said, a heightened risk of violence with limited available resources with the abuser maybe for 24 hours a day with no breaks, or having 24-hour surveillance by that abusive partner. And then we see a lot of mental health costs as well with helplessness, being overwhelmed, kind of this heightened isolation, you know, idea. And I wanted to stop here and pause for a second too, because, so I've kind of teased it throughout this presentation, but at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw a significant decline in our helpline calls, to where, you know, our helpline advocates weren't seeing calls even come in a day. And we were like, what is happening? How do we address this? And we realized that a lot of people didn't even have a safe moment to call us, or not a moment alone to call us. So we went out, the prevention department, my department, we put together this flyer, and I went out to gas stations, grocery stores, churches, places of worship, anywhere that I could post this flyer, you know, vet places, groomers, anyone that was still open and an essential business, just to let people know that we are still here. Like, you can still call us. We have not shut down. And we introduced this email option as well. You know, so if somebody is not able or not in a safe position to call, they can email this anonymous email address and get help right away as well. There is always somebody checking that email too. So then, you know, we also started, you know, shifting our daily practices and, you know, procedures to meet the needs of the pandemic. So when it first happened, we moved all of our shelter clients out, did a deep clean of the entire shelter, and then they were all put up in hotels. And then we brought everybody back in a staggered way. Normally you would get a suite where two families could share a suite. We had to, you know, take that out and just do it as one person per suite. And that, you know, some of our services did have to be on hold. So like I mentioned with the therapy note, we couldn't ensure safety with our support groups. We couldn't ensure confidentiality or privacy. So that was the thing that we had to put on hold, unfortunately. But as a response to the pandemic, the flyer campaign, like I mentioned, and then our development team and our executive director, we've basically been like, anybody who wants to give us an interview, let's do it, you know? So I've even given some interviews so far to, you know, high school groups and organizations, to some clubs, any magazines, you know, that are looking to do a story. We've been really proactive about getting the word out that those who are experiencing intimate partner violence are being highly affected by this pandemic. And then my last little part of my presentation here is how can we help as loved ones? How can we help in any role that we serve? And if there's one thing I want you all to take away from this presentation is that saying I believe you to somebody who is experiencing domestic violence is always appropriate, and it's one of the most impactful things you can do. Oftentimes, people experiencing domestic violence are told every single day that they are not worthy, that no one will believe them, that if they even seek services, X, Y, or Z could happen to them. So saying I believe you is oftentimes, you know, the most impactful thing you can say to somebody. And then all these little blurbs are also great as well. But just some, you know, steps that we can all take is just, you know, listening without judgment. It can be really hard sometimes, especially when we as loved ones are hearing the abuse happen or hearing about the abuse happen. And that can bring up a lot in us, right? You know, in terms of thinking, well, why are they still with them? Why don't they just leave? But that always understanding that the survivor or the person experiencing violence knows their safety, knows their situation the best. Believing their story, sharing your concern for their safety when it is appropriate. So, you know, obviously not when, you know, their partner might be around, supporting their decisions, no matter what they are, providing resources when you can and when you know them. And then lastly, and the biggest one that is the most valid, is that you don't need to be an expert in domestic violence to be there for somebody. And oftentimes the fear in us lies in that, okay, great, you just told us all of these things that we can do, but what happens when someone says yes? Like, what happens when someone says, yes, I've been abused? And that, you know, grounding yourself that you don't need to be a social worker, you don't need to have all of the things there, that sometimes you can just be a friend. You know, so asking, you know, how is it going can be a really positive and really impactful, powerful question. Listening up and listening with your own agenda to the story, and making sure you're staying connected to these people as well. And I think that this little grid, does a great job explaining some great responses, you know, especially the one in the first column, second down, that says, you know, wow, I don't even know what to say right now, but I'm so glad that you told me this. And that is okay. And that you can also say something like, wow, I don't even know how to respond. Let me look into, you know, doing my own research, and I would love to, you know, reach back out with you. You know, saying things like, thank you for telling me, you are not alone in this. It's not your fault. You get to choose what you do next, right? Restoring that power and that empower back in those survivors of domestic violence. And lastly, just going through some of our day's services, because a lot of people do know us as, you know, that we are the only domestic violence shelter in Dane County. So we are always at capacity. We are always at a wait list, but we do not operate under a first come, first serve basis. It's under a lethality risk assessment. So essentially we're looking at how dangerous, how lethal the environment that that person is leaving and coming into our shelter. But we also have a 24-hour, 100% anonymous, 100% confidential helpline that anybody can call. The amount of times we get service providers like other social workers or therapists, you know, mental health coaches, healthcare people, doctors, nurses, they all call us too, you know, asking like, hey, did I give my patient, you know, or my client the right information? Do you know, does this sound good? And yes, there will always be someone to answer anything that you have to wonder about. Then we do case management services. So you don't have to be a client of our shelter to receive case management. And then we do legal advocacy, children's program, and then the two parts of primary prevention and outreach education, which are me. They mentioned it at the beginning, but we do a primary prevention program called Men's Club. So it stands for Men Encouraging Nonviolent Strength. And I get to run that with middle and high school boys in our area. And it is my favorite part about my job, but I do want to plug also that we have an adult men's group, which is called Men in Conversation, which is if adult men want to come together once a month and they do a book club and they talk about how to address violence and how to be healthy men in their respective communities. So lastly, the gateway to all of our services is our 24-hour helpline. Take this down. Like I said, anybody can call any type of day, any time of the day. And then just to highlight two really quick additional community resources that we have found really helpful. Deaf Unity is for those in our community who identify as deaf who are experiencing intimate partner violence, and the Strong Hearts Native Helpline for those members of our community who are Indigenous or Native speaking. And that is all. Please take down my email if I missed anything that you're wondering about, if there's any clarifying questions you have for me. I work from home, so I am very available. So please, if you have anything, feel free to reach out to me. And that is my contact info. So thank you so much for bringing me in and letting me present to you all. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joey. We appreciate what you had to say and your energy.
Thank you.
We have time for questions. If you have questions, people can unmute yourself or raise your hand virtually, or I see Renee.
Thank you so much, Zoe. I think one thing that I still struggle with is the stereotypes. Like growing up, when you see in media, who is the abuser and who is the abused? It definitely, there are some stereotypes. And I grew up thinking, oh, that's never going to be, I'm never going to be an abused person. Like that person doesn't look like me. Like, don't have to worry about it. And I was in an emotional, verbal abusive relationship. And pretty much every single one of my friends has been in an emotional or verbal abusive relationship. And I think the stereotypes are definitely harmful because then people kind of disassociate with that and think like, that's not going to happen to me. And I have a feeling I won't do it. But if I ask people to raise their hand, if they've ever been in an emotional or verbal abusive relationship, I have a feeling there would be a lot of hands from a lot of people. And so I think that's something I still have to struggle with, is to remove the stereotypes from my mind.
Yeah,
and it's not my current relationship for everyone that's worried about me. I'm in a very happy, loving relationship now. But also the fact that there wasn't really any, I'm so happy to hear you're doing these groups with younger people, because there was really nothing in school that ever hit on. Right. I never even heard the term gaslighting until I think a year or two ago. Right. There was never any education in health class. That, you know, talked on any of this stuff. So I'm really happy to hear, and I hope that they're doing more, even like kind of required, part of the required things, not like an optional club, but that this, I'm hoping this is more into the health curriculum, because this is a health related thing.
Yeah. You know? Definitely. And thank you so much for sharing your story with us as well, too. I've been really impressed these past couple of years since I started my job that I am being brought into health and wellness classes, you know, because like that didn't even exist when I, you know, was in high school. And that, you know, these kiddos these days can learn what, you know, healthy or and versus toxic means, you know, for a relationship. So it's beautiful to see, you know, like you said, that, you know, with prevention, to not, I don't want to say normalize, because that sounds kind of like, but normalizing this, right? That, you know, it doesn't, we don't have to say abuse, you know, in these hushed tones, you know, that like abuse happens to people, and it happens, you know, not just to a specific group of people or to a specific type of person, you know? So thank you so much for bringing those comments and questions into the space as well.
Suzanne, unmute yourself. Suzanne,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I wanted to share a little bit of my story as well. When I was first married, when I was 21, I was in an abusive relationship, and it was mainly emotional abuse and isolation. I was 3,000 miles away from my family, mm-hmm. and began to be even further isolated from them. Yeah. And I didn't understand it at the time, though. I didn't know what was going on. I really didn't get it. And it wasn't until I used to pray that he would hit me, because then I would know I'd been abused and I would leave.
Right.
But what I was experiencing for the most part was not physical. So I didn't get it. I just didn't. Yeah. And ultimately, I found the courage to leave that relationship.
Yeah.
I had two amazing young men who are my children that I had in that relationship. And I've been remarried and with a very loving man for 38 years now. So it's a long time ago, but just hearing you speak was very triggering for me.
Yeah.
And I really began to feel my heart pounding and feel a lot of that emotion again.
Yeah.
And so in my 40s, I worked for a domestic violence agency.
Oh.
I didn't work, I volunteered. But I volunteered on a big level. I did the hotline for years. I did public presentations for them. I worked at, I spoke at women's prisons. I helped with support groups. I mean, yeah. I was full on in. And it wasn't until then that I understood that I had been abused.
Right, right.
I did not get it. And that's the thing that's so amazing. So I think it's so important for people like myself and like Renee to speak out, because then it can help to normalize it, not normalize it like it's okay, but yeah. normalize it like this could be happening to you too.
Yeah, exactly.
And, so I just want to thank you for what you're doing. I think it's so important. And I know back in the 90s when I was doing it, the statistic was 1 in 10.
1 in 10, yeah.
And so now for it to be 1 in 4, I think that's great, because I think that shows how much more education and awareness there is.
Exactly. Oh, thank you so, so much for sharing your story with us. And I, yeah, thank you so much for that and bringing that into this space. I really appreciate that. And yeah, you know, it's definitely, I would say, a tactic of abusers sometimes, you know, to make sure that the person experiencing the violence doesn't know that they're being abused, you know, right? Like that is a tactic in itself. To deflect that and to not, you know, to not bring that up at all. So yes, and thank you so much once again for that. I really appreciate it.
Mary Mullen, can you turn off your, turn yourself on? Yeah, there you go.
Oh, well, this is a question for Renee. You said that there are stereotypes of who's abused or who's the abuser. So I wondered what those stereotypes are.
The stereotypes I had was it was a person of color. Mm-hmm. That was probably the abuser and the abused, mm-hmm. primarily, and someone that was not, did not have a lot of money, not a lot of education. And since I didn't fit into any of those categories, I didn't really think I had anything to worry about. Yeah. And I think also that the depictions are usually physical. When we see them on media or yep. sexual, they're usually sexual or physical abuse. So you think someone's hitting someone. I'm also with Suzanne. That I kind of thought I could have left a lot sooner if he had actually hit me. And I would have recognized it faster as abuse and been like, out of there. But because it was, you know, the people do the like honeymoon period, people do like no, I don't think most abusers on your first date,
right?
You're hideous. Like, right. No one's doing that in the beginning. They're all sweet and honey. and kind of like you love them, right? And then you start the eggshell thing, and then there's a snapping or there's a put down or there's something, and then it goes back to honeymoon and then the eggshells, and that can go on for a long time before I think the person that is experiencing that can like recognize it as being unhealthy. Again, toxic and gaslighting. I never heard of those terms before. So yeah, I just had the stereotype of what abuse looked like. And I mean, it's not a conversation I have with my parents. My parents are super open and had lots of serious conversations. Not a conversation we had in school, not a conversation we had in college. I took women's studies and I don't even think it was part of that. Right. So, I mean, I'm really happy that we're talking more about this because I think it is happening a lot to a lot of people, and people just don't recognize it, don't want to talk about it. And I'm just really happy. I wanted this organization to come. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's always important to examine, because those stereotypes, you know, were intentional. They existed in the media for a reason, you know, like, and you know, what that does also to the communities of people, you know, who are people of color or who do have disabilities or who are, you know, part of a different education status, you know, what that does to them for seeking help also too, you know? So the stereotypes and these stigmas we have are not only operating within us, but they're operating outside of us as well. And that, you know, it's so important that you brought that up. And thank you so much for that.
Barb?
I had a very horrible incident in my life, is that I lost a dear friend, now I'm going to cry, to murder-suicide. It even happened at a separate dear friend's house, the murder-suicide. And we found at the funeral, her close friends, we found ourselves getting mad at her. We had this talk and we were like, why didn't she tell us? We would have harbored her.
Right.
And then we realized the error of saying that, but there wasn't as much talk like you are saying. It wasn't as open then. And that wasn't even a long time ago. It's just that it wasn't as much in the forefront. But right. we were angry at her. And it was like, oh my God.
Right.
So, yeah. And another thing about stereotypes, my son and his ex-wife, we're having an argument and she called 911 and they took her away.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. It's not, you know, classic.
Right. Two parts to that. First of all, also thank you for sharing that with all of us. And that, you know, like as loved ones, as people, you know, we are humans, we're allowed to feel, you know, like we, as people who are adjacent to people experiencing abuse sometimes, you know, there are so many feelings and so many emotions that we have that are so valid, you know, and that, you know, that feeling of like, gosh, like I could have helped, you know, if you would have just said something, I could have helped, you know, and then, but having, you know, it's hard to reground ourselves that like, you know, they knew their situation the best and maybe there was something standing in the way, you know, why they couldn't. But yes, thank you for bringing that into the space too. And I, you know, my heart goes out to you as well too. That was really impactful. And then the second part too, with what you said about the stereotypes as well. You know, just kind of with what we've all been saying, and I want to echo it, you know, the more we can talk about it and the more that we can, you know, where it doesn't feel like we have to be in these hushed tones, you know, about it, only increases the support and only increases the empowerment of those, you know, going through it where they feel seen and heard and validated. So thank you so much again for bringing that up.
Randy?
Thank you, Zoe. Very, very eloquent presentation. My question is, Kathy and I have been contributing financially to Dais for years. Mm-hmm. And I heard a couple of years ago that United Way kind of pulled out their total funding from you. Mm-hmm. How are things going in terms of fundraising for you folks?
It's been, thank you for that. And thank you for being a supporter of us as well. But yeah, since they pulled funding, it's been really hard in a lot of ways, but I would say, especially with the pandemic, we have seen so many community partners like step up and be like, hey, we heard about this, you know, how can we help? How can we support? You know, so there have been some other really significant funders that have stepped up for us, and that, you know, we have been so thankful, especially after our executive director, Shannon Berry, has done some pretty well-known articles at this point. I think, you know, like Wisconsin State Journal, Madison 365. And that after that awareness came out, then we had much more people being like, we didn't know about United Way, you know, please let us know how we can help. So it's been impacted, but it's also still been able to happen and thrive, you know, so our funding is still pretty good where we need it to be. Yeah. Thank you for the question.
Very good news. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. A little good news on a Sunday.
Time for one more question, Penny.
At the very beginning, you talked about it not being a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. And are you saying that abusers are mentally healthy?
No. So thank you for clarifying. Sorry, I didn't mean to, if you had more to that question, my apologies. Yeah, so... when I do education with younger folks and I would say college groups, we do the activity myth or fact. And I'm definitely not saying that those who are choosing to abuse are mentally healthy or unhealthy. I'm just bringing up that the stigma around it sometimes is, oh, this person chose to abuse their partner. They must be dealing with mental health. But that it's not also to say too, that somebody who is experiencing something like, you know, bipolar disorder, that abuse could be exasperated by that, right? Or that if they are having, you know, a moment where they're needing mental health support and then they turn it on to their partner, that's also a thing. Not saying that, you know, people who choose to abuse are, you know, all of them are unhealthy or all of them, you know, are dealing with a mental health issue. And that some people are, some people like aren't. But thank you for bringing that up to clarify. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for contributing. We can continue a little later in the discussion if you want. Zoe, you're welcome to stay with us. And Randy's going to read the closing words.
Never forget, walking away from something unhealthy is brave, even if you stumble a little on your way out of the door. Unknown author.
Our closing song today is singing the STJ 124 Be That Guide. I think, go ahead, Amber.
Yeah, I'm going to play through it all the way once and then we'll start singing.
And I think we have the words to put up somewhere. There we go. Sing along. It's time for a virtual coffee hour, and we'll start with if there's anyone who wants to introduce themselves, anyone who's visiting or has been here before and is returning.